Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So welcome everybody, and this is the third in our series on the polyvagal theory, and this webinar is called the Neural Love Code, which is something that Stephen Porges talks about. So we're going to see some excerpts, three excerpts from some of his talks from 2013, and talk about some of the concepts that he raises here, which really have implications for therapeutic relationships, but also you could say, you know, friends, friendly relationships or intimate relationships even. So I'm going to show you some video clips from him talking, as I said, but also some PowerPoint presentations as well. And we'll do some exercises too. Some of these are taken from a couple of books that Liz Hampson recommended me to get, which I've bought, which is this one by Deb Dana, which is very good, came out recently, The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy. And Deb is going to be running some webinars for us next year as well. And there's a whole series that she does on YouTube if you want to have a look at those. And she also was helped to edit this book along with Stephen Porges, Clinical Applications of the Polyvagal Theory, which is also another book which I would highly recommend. So thank you, Liz, for that. So I'm going to start just by showing you a few PowerPoint images, and then we will we'll move on to the video of Stephen Porges. So I'll just get this up for you. So the Neural Love Code. Unfortunately, Elma and Katie are not with us today. But anyway. So we've mentioned Stephen Porges' work, and specifically what we're going to be concentrating on now today is how people can go into what Stephen calls immobilization without fear. So the old vagus, if you remember from the previous webinars, is primarily to do with defensive strategies for shutdown. So it's that old ancient part of our vagus, which very primitive creatures have. So we'll talk about the immobilization without fear is very different, because we use that a lot in intimate relationships, and we use it a lot in therapeutic session. For example, when someone's lying on our couch, we want them to feel safe. Because if they don't feel safe, then the therapy really isn't going to work. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, and also we're going to talk about the role of play and what he calls mobilization without fear, so as opposed to immobilization, which is really a ventral vagus thing, the new vagus thing. Mobilization without fear is to do with how we engage the sympathetic system in a safe way to move it out of freeze. And we can do this in various ways through play. And we're going to show you some examples of that as well. So I thought we should start by looking at some of the ways that we can engage this new vagus, sometimes called the ventral vagus, because it's anterior to the old dorsal vagal part of our system. So the ventral vagus is the myelinated part. So I thought we'd just start with a few exercises to get in touch with this, because, you know, it's very important for us as therapists to be able to track this in ourselves and in our clients. So, for example, one of the things that Stephen Porges talks about is in a therapeutic context, or in life in general, is the difference between compassion and empathy. And the way he describes this, and I know it's been described in different ways, but the way he describes this is that empathy is where you might, maybe you're feeling someone's pain, yes, if you like, and so that's in that situation, it's quite easy to get caught up in your sympathetic nervous system. So that can happen when we're working with clients, and we can notice that in ourselves, yes. So when we start to get activated, and there are various signs to that, aren't there? Like the way that our breathing changes, the way our face feels, etc. And then, oh, hi, Katie's here. Good, excellent. So yes, yeah, so compassion, the way he talks about compassion is more coming from ventral vagus, or the being more in the ventral vagus enables compassion to arise. It's more likely to arise in that situation. It's a very different way of engaging, you could say, with our clients. And generally speaking, a compassionate approach is going to help people a bit more. So I thought we'd just start with a few maybe exercises around this. So we could start, one way he talks about engaging the ventral vagus is by the through the breath. And this is something we can do for ourselves and also something we can do with our clients. So he talks quite a bit about how long exhalations help activate the afferent pathways to the heart and therefore the ventral vagus. So long exhalations we can do consciously. We do it naturally when, say, we are giving a talk. So as I'm speaking now, if I use fairly long phrases and don't breathe, then obviously that in itself is going to activate my ventral vagus. If I was to do very short sentences and speak fairly fast, I'm less likely to activate my ventral vagal system. And of course, then we can consciously do it through breath. And a lot of rituals that, for example, in religious circumstances. So, for example, singing, chanting. Chanting is very interesting because chanting uses the breath a lot. It uses a lot of exhalation. And it uses the throat and prosody, variations in tone. It uses your ears to listen. And it uses your eyes to read. So for example, so that's a very, very, chanting is classically a very, very good way for activating your ventral vagus. And so we could try a little bit of this, some slow breathing. So one of the ways that we can do this, the Human Givens Institute have a way of doing this, which is, they call it a 7-11 breath. So where you breathe in for seven, count of seven. And when you're breathing in, it's important to activate the diaphragm. That movement of the diaphragm is actually really important in this as well. And then the exhalation is on a count of 11. So we try that. We could just try that. If I just count, it's a bit artificial, but I could just count and we'll see how we go with it. So as we breathe in, so if I just count slowly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in, and then exhalation, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and then breathe in. And you can count yourself now. So you might notice that as you begin to do that, I could already feel my nervous system calming down as I was doing that. If you want to write any comments, by the way, as we go along, please do. And Katie, if you want to say anything as we go along, please do as well. Or Julian, thank you. So that's one example. There's a few different examples. Sighing is a very good one. And sighs happen quite naturally in the therapeutic process. They're often a sign of something changing, of something being let go. And as therapists, we can use sighs. And yawning, Katie. I just saw you yawn. the voice. And so how we use the voice. I'll come back to this later. But again, we've talked a lot about this, the use of prosody, inflection. And is very important rather than a flat tone. When we use a flat tone, people find it more difficult to read us. And the way Stephen talks about this is in terms of our last webinar about neuroception, a lot of these keys, what we're looking for in relationship, whether it's a therapeutic relationship or any other relationship, is cues of safety. And so prosody in the voice, when you can tell where someone's coming from. If they've got a very flat voice, you can't. And I'm going to give you quite a funny example of that shortly as well. Things like stillness, for some people, may activate their ventral vagus, or it may not. So it's because some people find stillness quite activating. I remember when I was teaching in Kuwait a few years ago, and I was staying with a family, a really lovely man. And we had some lovely conversations in the evenings about religion. And he was one of the few people that I ever met where I would say, raise a point with him or ask him a question, and he would pause. So he just would not speak, maybe for 20, 30 seconds. And then he'd engage. And it took a while for me to get used to it, because we're so used to that kind of rapid fire exchange. So for some people, being still can feel almost threatening. So it's not automatically. And the same with touch. So for some people with touch can be stimulating. It can also be very nurturing. And so in Deb Dana's book, she talks a lot about different ways of engaging the ventral vagus through touch. So classically, for example, if we make connections between our heart, and we can do this ourselves, we could try this now. So if you, for example, if you put your hand on your around your heart area, the connections from your heart go to various places, like your ear, your face. So if you made a connection, say, between this hand and your face, and you just hold that, that automatically starts to, or you might feel that, is generally quite a kind of nurturing and nurturing touch. I can feel that for myself. The other place we could contact is between the heart and the back of the head. The back of the head here in the brainstem is where all these vagal nuclei are. So that's quite a nice relationship to hold as well. And again, in Stanley Rosenberg's webinar that he did for us on his book, he uses quite a lot of touch around the back of the head, around the occiput, again, right near the brainstem. So we'll come back to touch. Movement is an interesting one. And again, Deb Dana talks a bit about this, and we'll come back to this as well. Particularly in terms of play, for example. Sorry, it's my phone going off there in the background. So in terms of play, how we might mobilize people out from a more frozen state. Because in a frozen state, we want to get them from that frozen state more into a sympathetic state, and then perhaps more into a ventral vagal state. So so one way of doing that is through gentle, very safe kind of movements, which might be play. They might be kind of micro movements. So, for example, sitting on a yoga ball or a Pilates ball or something like this, where there's a little bit of instability. For me, I quite often suggest these wobble cushions. You've probably seen these things, but they can be very good. They're also very good for sort of core strength for people with back problems who sit a lot, because they induce a slight instability. So as you're sitting on them, you there's a little bit of a wobble. So the simple, very simple things like that. They're not suitable for everybody, but they can be very helpful sometimes. So the neural love code is what we're going to be talking about. And Stephen talks about this in terms of a code, because there is a kind of structure to it. You can't have, there has to be a kind of in order. And the first thing is safety. And that's what we look for. So you need to have safety before you can bond effectively. Now, that's not always true, because people do bond with people who are not particularly safe. And then you get all kinds of situations, you know, in more abusive relationships that happens. But ideally, we want safety first. And we'll come back to all these points, but and we'll listen to Stephen talking about this. But also, there needs to be some reciprocity. So this is an exchange, you could say, certainly in relationship. Now, this reciprocity is very different in a therapeutic relationship to an intimate relationship, say. So in an intimate relationship, ideally you want a situation, say, perhaps where someone's needs are more at one time than the other, and than the other. So there's a give and take all the time, yes? And there's a kind of balance in that situation. Stephen talks about a sort of reptile mammal kind of relationship where that might be very out of balance, for example. But in a therapeutic relationship, of course, reciprocity is very different because there isn't quite the same level of give and take. Normally speaking, a therapist might share a little bit about their personal stuff, which is going on, which is going to be very helpful because that helps to bring some reciprocity into this relationship. But generally speaking, a therapist won't share as much. So there is a slight imbalance there, which is worth investigating. And then mobilization with that fear can come in play. You see this a lot in intimate relationships, for example, in flirting, for example. Flirting or sort of horseplay. You see a lot of teenagers do this kind of thing, don't you? So that's a way of engaging safety, you could say, before you go into the immobilizer. So mobilization without fear tends to come before immobilization without fear, which is where more intimacy happens. And then then immobilization and touch without fear is where we come in as therapists. So all these things need to be in place before that can happen. And I showed some of these pictures before. I like this one. This is mobilization with fear, which is very, very different to a kind of play situation like this. And I was trying to find an example of this in a film. And I did find one, which is a slightly extreme, but it's quite interesting. So it's a kind of way of two people interacting using mobilization without fear. But actually what they do, there is quite a lot of fear in it. So there's a lot of ambivalence in this little clip here. But what happens is, and what Stephen talks a lot about, is in order for this to happen, in order for any kind of intimacy to happen, in order for immobilization without fear to happen, there has to be a lot of face-to-face. So what you'll see in this is a certain bit of rough and tumble, and then some face-to-face, and then a bit more rough and tumble, and then more face-to-face. Because if you don't have the face-to-face, there isn't any reparation. So this is a short clip from a film, which I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, oops. And here we go. It's a bit cheesy, this thing. Sorry.
Hey, bad girl.
Car, what the hell are you doing here?
Lose this?
I didn't lose it. You stole it.
That's not true.
You're a liar. Come on, you're a pickpocket. You expect me to believe that?
Yeah, I'm a nice guy. I wouldn't steal from you.
You can't lie for shit.
I'm a terrific liar. Okay, I did take it. But I was borrowing.
Yeah, I think it's probably enough of that. you get the idea. So it's a little bit ambivalent there between, you know, whether how serious they are about it. So other ways are through sound, and and awe. I mean, we see this a lot in music. And I just want to I just want to play you just a little bit of music, and then we'll go on to hearing Stephen talk about this. So the way he talks about sound is that a lot of composers will use a very similar kind of tonal quality or range that mimics maternal voices. So you'll hear in this piece, which is a choral piece, there is not much low frequencies. So low frequencies tend to be associated more with kind of predator, you could say. So there's not many low frequencies, and there's very, very long phrases, which if you're a singer, will naturally activate your ventral vagus. So this is a piece by Samuel Barber called Agnus Dei, and it's actually an arrangement of a string piece that he wrote. And I'll just play you just a few minutes of this because it's very, very beautiful. So you can sink into your ventral vagus as you listen to this. That one. It's one of my favorite pieces of music, that one.
Beautiful.
Again, Stephen talks about the spaces we create for exploring, if you like, what comes from being with our ventral vagus. And for that, again, we need these safe spaces. You often find places like cathedrals, you know, they have big, thick walls and very, you know, and then you also have this a sense of awe, which also will stimulate that whole thing as well. And generally speaking, these spaces that we create naturally to enhance this in ourselves generally don't involve that much movement. So movement, when we view movement, that tends to activate more our vigilance, you could say, our hypervigilance. So spaces like this, I showed these on some of the craniosacral stillness webinar I did, but spaces like this, there is very, very little movement. This is in Stourhead, and it's designed that way so that it calms your system down. It's the same thing when we look at mountains like this. There's no movement here, particularly on a clear day. It's different when you're watching something like this where there's lots of movement, say with the clouds and stuff. But here, there's no movement. And the same with still water. We love to watch still water for the same reasons. So I think what we'll do now is have a look at Stephen talking about the neural love code. And this is from 2013. And he is, he's been talking for a few minutes already. So we'll just go straight into this. And yeah, here we go.
And this is really what I call the body's need to engage and bond. And I think we actually had several of these ideas presented yesterday. And the idea is that our nervous system evolved as a mammal not to be by ourselves. We evolved to be connected, to be engaged with others. And so our nervous system is looking for the other. And so we have these receptors or these feature detectors that try to find certain aspects in others that make us feel safe and comfortable. So a biological quest for safety in the proximity of another is part of what it is to be a mammal. And this becomes a major mediator of mental and physical health, and it explains the health benefits of social support. And now we have a second test. Okay. So we see a mother and the infant, and now we know where to look, don't we? So we're looking at the upper part of the face, and suddenly it all starts to make sense, I hope. Okay. So we see that the upper part of the face, we look at this couple, and again, we see the upper part of the face. We see enough in the upper part of the face that it's something that is a glint or a positive cue. We see it in these primates, and we see it in this cross-species relationship. You see the face-to-face, and you see the proximity. And in all four of these panels, the individuals are safe. And we see that and we respond to that. And then again, if we look at these, how do we feel? We feel that the people aren't safe in those environments and we don't want to enter that. We don't like it because they're turned away, the neck is shifted, the proximity, the turning away. And the turning away is a profound cue to our nervous system. And people get into violent arguments when someone turns away from them. But, well, you know, I have to do my texting, so I have to turn away, right? I can't wait. And you understand that the type of social networking that we do is literally triggering a disruption of the formation of normal social connectedness. So that people are not looking at each other, they're not talking to each other, they're texting, and they're texting a lot. They're spending lots of time on smartphones and on the internet. Now, Myron Hofer, who is a psychiatrist who just recently retired from Columbia, had been very instrumental in talking about the relationship between a mother and an infant as both a behavioral social relationship, but also as a regulator of physiology. Okay, and the point of this is to think of the mammal, and we are mammals, not as unitary or single organisms, but part of a dyad at least. Okay, unlike reptiles, they drop their eggs, the eggs hatch, and the individual reptiles go off on their own. And our phylogenetic ancestors were reptiles. In fact, our true ancestor was something like a land tortoise, a turtle. And you'll start seeing some of our own very primitive reactions to be very turtle-like. We didn't evolve from birds, and we didn't evolve from lizards or snakes. We evolved from something that was like a turtle. So from turtles came mammals. And mammals have some basic features. They needed nurturance. They needed to be taken care of. And they also had some very unique features that included, you'll learn a little bit later, a myelinated vagus that was linked in the brainstem with the nerves that control the muscles of the face. So from the get-go, mammals were able to wear their heart on their face and to use vocalizations, not language, but vocalizations, to convey their physiological state. And all mothers know that. Okay. But we've kind of forgotten that in our society, that it's the intonation of the voice that's conveying the information, not the words. And we often say, well, that's what I said, but we know what you meant. So I had a wonderful assistant when I was at the University of Illinois for over 10 years, just wonderful. But she was brought up with a specific religious orientation that made it difficult for her to articulate or say bad things about people. But it was all in the intonation of her voice. And she used to get so angry at me because I would basically deconstruct what she really said. And it's very easy. We all live with people who say things but don't mean it, because they feel that it's wrong to say something bad about a person, but they're saying something good that they don't believe, which conveys a certain level of information that lacks the authenticity. Well, it's authentic, but it's false. So the point I want to make is that mammals require the interaction of another mammal, of an other, and we need others throughout our entire lifespan. So from infancy, we're dependent for many years on someone to protect us and provide food, and then on the other part of the lifespan, as we age, we're also dependent upon other. And then during the productive years, we like to have others around us because it enables us to feel safe and to do other things. Now, part of this has to do with our phylogenetic history. Mammals need to sleep, and they need to sleep in safe environments, and they also need to eat. They have big brains, they have to feed these things. And so they need to structure environments in where their body can be safe. And the building of structures, of homes, has always been to create this physical environment where they could give up vigilance and relax, and then use the nervous system for health, growth, and restoration. And again, we are in a dialectic now. We are in a conflict because society is not safe.
Cool. Do you want to say anything before we go on to the next little bit, which is about mobilization without fear? Do you want to say anything about that at all or make any comments? Sorry to put you on the spot.
I agree with what Stephen Porges. I agree with what Stephen Porges is saying. I think, you know, as a human race, I think we are in a crisis of a disconnection from care. We've all got the same motivational drives and needs as humans that all other mammals have, but because of how we've evolved, we've become disconnected from our humans with each other and from care and you know, how society's developed, you know, with people on their phone, people texting, and it's a real dilemma.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but we haven't really thought this through, have we, how that stops our normal interactions, which are kind of hardwired into us, like face-to-face, not being able to read people and things like this. Yeah.
John, just to mention, your audio just at the end of the play of that video has gone a bit robotized and distorted. I wonder...
Maybe it's the connection or something. Yeah.
Sounds better now, actually.
Okay. So we're going to go into the next clip. This is another short clip from the same thing, a little bit further into the lecture, where he's talking about immobilization without fear and clues of safety. So we'll go on to this one. Is the volume all right on the video, is it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Sir. Okay, cool.
Because your nervous system, like other mammals, is picking up these cues. And here is a dog, a traumatized dog. And what are they doing? They're trying to create stillness and calmness and safety in a rescued dog. So we have a second phase, and that is the importance of physical contact while immobilizing without fear. And I like to always say that this is really what the goal of society is for. It's to enable us to immobilize without fear. It's to create safe structures, safe institutions, so that we don't have to be hypervigilant. We don't have to be reactive to what's going on in the world. So this is immobilization with fear, something we want to juxtapose that to. Because immobilization with fear is shutting down. It is death and can produce death in some situations. So we really have something that I'm calling a love code. Now, why is it a code? It's because the sequence is critical. We have to feel safe with someone before we bond with the person. If we bond with the person and don't feel safe with them, which can happen, then we have really problems. We have situations where people feel they can't live with the person, but they can't live without the person. So they have grief when they're not with the person or loss, but when they're with the person, they have aggressive oppositional situations and they're basically scared. And you have a lot of abusive families, abusive relationships that are based upon a misunderstanding of the neural love code, what our body needs. So this is, in a sense, a deconstruction of a simple code. But the code, the reason I call it code, it's like a combination lock. The order of the input has to be in a fixed way. We have to first feel safe with the person before we can bond. So we can't bond and then later feel safe. We better feel safe first. And what does feeling safe mean? It means that the psychological and physical cues enable us to get close. And then when we are conforming and physically in contact with the other, then the neurochemistry, that's when the oxytocin and other physiological events start to occur that result in more profound, more permanent bonding. So in a sense, we test the waters with this side. And what I used to say to my wife was that we basically divide the world. She studies this part, I study this part, and there's basically, it's almost like a male-female bit. This is like the area of seduction, and this is the area of true, real relationships, you know. And the issue is that people who study attachment get locked into this without understanding or acknowledging that there's a functional preamble to being attached. And this seems to be lost. And so the issue of feeling safe opens the portals for selectivity in how we attach and with whom we attach. Now, when we start looking at healthy relationships, we see this. But when we start looking at mental health problems, when people have been traumatized or have other mental health issues, what do we see? We see that they have difficulties feeling safe with others. They feel uncomfortable being in physical proximity. They don't like to go out in public. They want to be home alone. They can control that space. They feel that being touched or touching others is for other people, not for them. And they have difficulty establishing trusting relationships. I've had people who said, we're not a touching family. We're not a family that gives hugs. And I'm sure you've all heard that. It's not part of our culture. And what are they really saying to you? They're saying that they're very uncomfortable being touched. That touching is a sense of threat and their body is like this, tightly wrapped and reactive. So features of mental health are difficulties in this entire continuum. And I use the word continuum with special permission. But we start with safety, and of course you have to see it as moving to the establishment. It doesn't have to be intimate bonds or intimate contact. But when you have friends and you give a friend a hug, it doesn't mean that you're going to go to bed with them in the next hour. Okay. It's because we feel comfortable and we feel that touching them and they're touching you is supporting who we are and supporting who they are. So what are the physiological mechanisms that mediate social engagement and immobilization without fear? I mean, this is really the goal in life. And I think this is really part of what you folks, many of you, are trying to do with your clients. You're trying to understand and to help them sit still, feel comfortable with another, being able to utilize their nervous system as a collaborator for both mental health and physical health. And so this is all now based on the polyvagal theory. And what the polyvagal theory does is it articulates how these systems, physiological systems, evolved and how they get triggered. And in the workshop tomorrow, I will actually go through a lot more of this. So I'm not going to go too deeply. We'll just kind of breeze over it, try to keep it simple. So what the theory proposes is that therapeutic strategies should focus on turning off defenses. Okay. What we really want to do is, again, if we listen to the previous talks, what are the talks all about? Turning off defense. Because when you turn off defense, the nervous system is your collaborator for health and for social behavior, physical and mental health. And if we're defensive, we have changed our ability to react to the world. Now, our defensiveness can be adaptive. It doesn't make it bad or wrong, but it becomes inappropriate or inefficient for supporting health and social behavior. So the polyvagal theory identifies the mechanisms for turning on and off these defenses, and it provides insights into how clinical strategies can be used to dampen defensive reactions. So it, in a sense, will tell you, by understanding these systems, it tells you what cues you need in your clinical setting and in your social life and in educational settings to promote more healthy individuals. So the theory really in a very...
So I'm going to go back to a few PowerPoint slides, and then we're going to show one last piece from Stephen Porges where he deconstructs Burt Bacharach's song. It's absolutely brilliant. So anything else? Have anybody got any questions before we go on to this next piece? So we've talked about some of these things that help engage the ventral vagus. One thing around this is voice, and so using prosody. So and you see this a lot in brought out in movies. So I think maybe I didn't share my sound again. I do apologize. I'm just going to share my sound. So a flat voice will signify danger. Yes. So you see this in movies. For example, those of you who are old enough to remember Doctor Who and the Daleks, and the Daleks always had this flat, you know, voice, exterminate. You know, it was like a very kind of thing. And there's one of my favorite movies is this one from 1996 called Mars Attacks, and it's a kind of comedy. But anyway, you get these Martians coming down. And this is the first time anybody on Earth has seen a Martian, and you'll hear the sound of his voice is just like this monotonous kind of barking sound. There we go.
Wait a moment. It's just
greetings. I am the Martian ambassador.
Everything is face now, General. You may speak.
Greetings. I am General Casey, commanding officer of the armed forces of the United States of America. on behalf of the people of Earth. Welcome.
You did that well.
I think that's probably enough of that anyway. there's a couple of areas where we can get ruptures in the therapeutic relationship, and that they tend to happen in two different ways, which are kind of related to what Stephen Porges was talking about. So one is more kind of withdrawal, and where perhaps something's happened in the therapy room. Maybe certain things have been activated too fast. Someone gets overwhelmed, or they don't just come back for another session, whatever that is, for whatever reason, where there's a withdrawal. And that's quite difficult sometimes to repair or get someone back from that. And the other thing then is where you get into a more confrontational situation. And again, this is played out on our TV screens. There's one of my favorite skits around this, which is from Nina Conti, who brings, if you're familiar with Nina Conti, she's a ventriloquist. And there's a wonderful series, if you ever get a chance to see it, called Nina Conti in Therapy. And she brings this ventriloquist dummy, which is a monkey, which is a foul-mouthed creature, and basically is highly confrontational. And so she brings it to therapy in order to try and give this monkey up, because he's sort of taken over her life. And so you see it, this whole thing being played out. So the monkey is very confrontational, but his owner, who is the ventriloquist, Nina Conti, will often then go completely into withdrawal. So it's a very interesting dynamic. And this poor therapist is left with this dilemma of how to deal with it, how to repair this therapeutic situation. I'm just going to show you just a few seconds of this, because you can watch it online. This is actually their first session where they meet.
Comfortable?
Yes. Hello. Hello. This is it. You see, this is monkey.
This is monkey.
Yeah. Hi. So thank you for seeing us. It's a little unusual, huh? Do any of your clients have monkeys?
This is certainly an unusual situation. It's first for me, but that's very much what you were saying on the phone, that you wanted to be able to come to a session whereby you could bring your puppet with you. And you were saying on the phone that you'd found it actually quite difficult to find a therapist who would allow you to bring your puppet into the session with you.
Mm, yeah, well, actually, I didn't ask, but I was probably put off by the blurb. She liked your picture.
Well, let's start by looking at why it is that you want to give up monkey.
I am the sickness. It's a kind of a... It's a funny thing, it, and it's also... a crutch thing. I'm stronger than her. I think it's because it feels as if I've become a thing without him, which feels to me like a subtraction from myself. Mm-hmm. You know? And now she's found herself to be a sidekick in her own life. I provide a little addictive hit. You know, I get, how so, monkey? Well, you know, I say a thing, makes her heart beat faster, makes her think, ooh, did I get away with that? Makes me embarrass, monkey. Yeah, God, you like it. I find it makes my heart race, yeah. But that's not enjoyable.
So there's a lot happening here already.
Mm. I know.
So let's just try to focus on maybe one thing at a time.
Is this? Like, so called thong and short is the shit this is. I don't know what it is. It's endless.
I think we'll leave it there, because you can watch this on YouTube if you want. It's an absolutely hilarious whole series of eight therapy sessions, which are all improvised. And it's very interesting to watch this poor therapist trying to repair this relationship where the monkey goes continually into confrontation and Nina Conti continually goes into collapse. So it's a real masterclass in therapy nightmare, I would say. So just wanted to show you one more clip from Stephen Porges. And this is the last bit of his presentation where he deconstructs a song by Bert Bacharach in terms of the polyvagal theory. So it's going to get this up for you, sorry. Let's find it for you. And if you've got any questions, then please do ask them. So at the beginning of this, he gets a little bit, there's a little bit of a sound, a problem with him getting the sound up. So you just have to...
Not merely to fill up the time, there's a real reason here. Oh, let's see. One second, let's...
Let this be just once, a start.
One second. We want to start it from the beginning. One moment.
Let's take a lover's bow and then seal it with a kiss.
It has to.
I can hardly wait to hold you.
Ah, okay, we're okay.
Can't disguise.
Okay, so we just skip the eyes for a moment.
The look of love, it saying so much more than just words could ever say.
More than words, okay?
And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around.
Okay, so now. Okay, now it's time for you to really understand what Bert Bacharach and Hal David were trying to say, okay? So. So, you know, they were ahead of their time, that's all I can say. The look of love is in your eyes, which means gaze in the orbicularis oculi. The look your smile can't disguise because the facial muscles, especially the upper part of the face, is involuntary. The look of love is saying so much more because there are facial neck and lip muscles than just words could ever say. This was the whole issue of prosody and intonation of voice. But there's more. And what my heart has heard, the vagal regulation of the heart, the middle ear muscles, and the face-heart connection. Well, it takes my breath away. Now, they are really sophisticated because of the vagal regulation of the bronchi, and here is the real clincher to tell you that they really understood. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. Immobilization without fear. Okay.
Great. So if you want to see any more of those, they are available from Al Productions, Elmer Postle filmed that, and also Stephen Porges' workshop that he referred to as well, if you want to get that from Al Productions. I'll put the link up later for you. So we've just got a few minutes left. Does anybody want to share anything or say anything, ask any questions before we stop? Katie or Julian, do you want to say anything more about this?
I've enjoyed it. I'm glad Katie could join us. The sound is still a little bit strange. It seems to be from when you switch between the player and back to your voice. But
okay.
Katie, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, that's just so wonderful. Stephen Porges' interpretation of that song, like translating it into what's happening into the interpersonal neurobiology. And I'm thinking about like polyvagal theory in relation to Jaak Panksepp's emotional command systems and the interrelationship between the nervous system responses and our limbic emotional command systems. Like, for example, the play system is all about its function is for win-win relationships and belonging, ultimately. because we need to belong to survive, and to survive we need to not hurt each other. We need to know each other's limits and our own limits. And animals doing rough and tumble play, power over, power under, they're always looking at each other's eyes to say, you know, we're playing. And that supports me to immobilize with safety and know that you're not going to kill me. And it supports me to test my power with you and know that I'm not going to kill you. And so the play emotional command system is central to, its relationship between the ventral vagus. The play system supports us to upregulate into sympathetic nervous system activation, and also to downregulate into dorsal vagus immobilization with safety. And it's a vital part of Eros, vital part of us being able to immobilize with each other with safety and be in win-win reciprocity with each other in all of our relationships, you know, whether they're romantic or business or any kind of relationship. We need to belong, we need to know that we're safe with each other.
And I guess a lot of the way that we interact at the moment with through social media doesn't necessarily feel safe. So, yeah. So Raluca's asking about, please share one or two ways of calming down clients during the therapy who are very agitated. I mean, there's quite a big subject, Raluca. Maybe I could refer you to Stanley Rosenberg's webinar on this and his book, which is very, very good, very practical around all this. And also, Peter Levine's work on this, because there's a lot of different aspects to that which are a little bit complicated. Great. Okay. Any other questions? Andrew is saying, I'm wondering why social engagement is pleasurable and stressful both at the same time. Do you want to say anything about that, Katie?
Well, pleasurable. It's like the more you are you, the more I can be me. And I'm also thinking about, like, sometimes it's a joy to be hidden and a disaster never to be found, is a quote from Donald Winnicott. Mm. So being seen and allowing myself to see you means I'm going to be exposed, or I'm going to, and being exposed and being seen, if once upon a time being seen in my authenticity meant I got punished or cast out, then being seen could be frightening, and there might be fear there. But it is a disaster never to be seen, to stay in hiding. And we've all adapted to belong, and in that adaption, we've all lost some part of our authenticity. And that's what we're bridging here. We're bridging our adaptive selves with our authentic spontaneity, our naturalness. And so being seen is thrilling, because I'm going to be found, and it means I've got the possibility of intimacy, but I've also got the possibility of rejection. Mm. If being seen in my naturalness once upon a time meant that I was punished or rejected in some way, or humiliated, or it wasn't possible for me to be expressing myself in the way that I expressed myself as a child, for example. And then we carry these fears of being rejected again into our adult relationships, and they become like internal dialogue interrupters of us expressing ourselves and trusting our spontaneity and opening up our senses to receive the communications from inside of ourselves to share. So it's a thrilling and rewarding, but also can have fear interruptions, depending on how possible it was for us to be in our naturalness, you know, in our history, you know, and still belong. Mm.
Wonderful, thank you. Good. So next year we're gonna have Deb Dana join us. So we'll be continuing this conversation. And there's new developments in clinical applications of the polyvagal theory constantly. So it'll be great to have Deb with us next year. And I think we're taking a break for Christmas. And so happy Christmas to everybody and New Year. And we're back on the 7th of January. And that's with Liz Koch, who is going to be talking about the SOAS. She's going to be running a series for us in February. So that'll be an introduction to her series on the 7th of January. Yes, and then we have James Earls on the 14th. And every Tuesday after that, we'll have a presenter. So thank you very much for listening, and happy Christmas, and we'll see you next year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
Thank you, Gillian. Thank you everyone for joining us. Yeah, Merry Christmas.